The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban. You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. And today we read from the December 2019 edition of Smithsonian. In the American Grain, searching for the essence of the prickly, brilliant, deeply influential Frank Lloyd Wright by Paul Hendrickson. Frank Lloyd Wright, the greatest architect this country has yet produced, was born 2 years after the end of the Civil War and died not quite 2 years after the launch of Sputnik, 91 years and 10 months on the Earth. In his cape and pork pie hat, those goofy pants, almost pantaloons, that were pegged at the ankles, he strutted through our national imagination for something like a 7-decade career. His work has been built over 3 centuries, 19th, 20th, and 21st. I know it reads like a typo, but I'm referring to the handful of posthumous works that, for one reason or another, didn't get around to being built until long after his death in 1959. In his 72-year career as an architect and egotist, Wright managed to design more than 1,100 things, a staggering amount by any artistic measurement. There were churches, schools, offices, banks, museums, hotels, medical clinics, an automobile showroom, a synagogue, a mile-high skyscraper, and one exotic-looking Phillips 66 gas station in Cloquet, Minnesota. Overwhelmingly, though, there were houses, shelters for mankind, and by that fact alone, I think there is something slyly to be said about his fundamental decency as a human being. By no means did all of it get built. Not quite half of all his drawings and designs and studies were realized, and a little more than 400 still came magically out of the American ground, looking for light. Falling Water, near Pittsburgh, the Guggenheim Museum on Fifth Avenue, the Johnson Wax Building in Racine, Wisconsin, Unity Temple in Oak Park, Illinois, Roby House on the campus of the University of Chicago, to cite just 5 masterworks by their vernacular names. One of Wright's nearly lifelong dictums was that his buildings were like shrubs and trees, growing upward, in effect from the inside out, emerging spanking wet and blinking their eyes to the world. Okay, that's a different metaphor. It was all part of his gospel of organic architecture, even if his definitions of that concept were always shifting around, like verbal tectonic plates, and sometimes seemed to mystify even him. It was as if he knew what he meant, or at least felt, even if you didn't know, and even if in some ultimate spiritual and intellectual sense he didn't really know either. He didn't need to know. He just needed to conceive the thing, draw the thing, and make the thing. The thing had simply shaken itself out of my sleeve, the old shaman liked to say, ever his own publicist. Shelters for mankind, from the almost impossibly grand to the utilitarian bare and spare and functional, and all the more beautiful for such simplicity and environmental purity. He had a term for this latter kind of house, which I so deeply love, Usonian. The interior of a Frank Lloyd Wright house, whether a great ship on the prairie or just a little bird-like jewel you swear you could nest in your palm, is always about many things. But at the center of each one is the intertwined idea of openness and flow. No matter what else he did with the design of a house in his nearly 3/4 of a century as a revolutionary architect, whether hanging it on the lip of a waterfall in Pennsylvania, or sticking it mirage-like in the middle of a desert in Arizona, He was out to break the box, to destroy forever those tight, draped, dark horsehair, closed-off Victorian rooms of our 19th-century forebears. He wanted to let light in, and space in, air in, life in. And he did so radically, evangelically. It was a way of thinking and feeling he never let go of. He did it initially and most radically in his prairie houses, in and around the turn of the 20th century, which alone are enough to have made him immortal. The esteemed contemporary architecture critic Paul Goldberger once put it this way in regard to Wright. He really did feel that America, as this new democratic country, needed a new architectural expression that was horizontal, open in plan, open across the landscape, a sense somehow that it was connecting to that great open American land. He saw that American landscape, the openness of it, and the sense that it was always moving across the land, pushing westward. Throughout his life, Wright himself tried to articulate what he was doing in terms of this interlocking idea of openness and harmonious flow as it connects to the larger idea of freedom, and indeed to the still larger idea of America itself. 6 years before he died, he wrote, "To say the house planted by myself on the good earth of the Chicago prairie as early as 1900 or earlier was the first truly democratic expression of our democracy and architecture would start a controversy with professional addicts who believed architecture has no political, therefore no social, significance. So let's say that the spirit of democracy, freedom of the individual as an individual, took hold of the house as it then was, took off the attic and the porch, pulled out the basement, and made single, spacious, harmonious unit of living room, dining room, and kitchen with appropriate entry convenience. It was almost impossible to step inside any Wright work, but especially his houses, and mind you, he always tended to think of them as his houses. Hell with the client. And not get something out of this ineffable feeling of openness and freedom that somehow seems greater than the beautiful building itself. There are certain moments, standing in such spaces, if the light is falling right, when it will begin to seem as if Whitman is singing to Emerson, or vice versa, channeled through an ego that could see both of theirs in the great stakes game of fame and self-love, and raise it by half. There are also moments when what comes, as others before me have said, is the wonder of a religious feeling. What comes to me, I suppose, not every time, but often enough, is the glad idea of my Americanness, and not in any corny or jingoistic way. For all the terrible dross and refuse of his ego and arrogance, this confounding man and supreme artist left us with something essential that helps define us as Americans, or so I believe. Although, let it be said, he wasn't the first. His mentor, the great Lewis H. Sullivan, from whom Wright learned more about architecture than from any other person, was always way out ahead of the pupil on the gospel of creating an American architecture for Americans. Wright gets too much credit for that idea, not that he didn't understand the gospel in deeper ways than Sullivan, or raise it to far more brilliant levels. But the dream didn't originate with him. Just one more instance of the lifelong capacity for smooth appropriating. This feeling I am trying to pin down, the ineffable aspect, the American aspect, the sea to shining sea democratic aspect, comes to me almost every time I go back to my hometown of Kankakee, Illinois, and stand quietly before the B. Harley Bradley House. It is my boyhood Frank Lloyd Wright, the one I first saw circa 1953 on a J.C. Higgins maroon 3-speed. The bike was under the Christmas tree that year. The Bradley is the precursor prairie, the St. John the Baptist prairie. It came right at the light of the new century, 1900, Every time I go back, I am awed again by its interior gleams and quarter-sawn oak angularities and sheltering eaves and narrow bands of glittering art-glass windows, but not least awed by its uncanny interflowing spaces. Yes, he broke the box. Heck, I wonder if I even really knew the name Frank Lloyd Wright in 1953. I was just a downstate Catholic kid pedaling past an American wonder with the wrist strap of my Spalding ball glove hooked to my handlebars. This century on, the Bradley is there on the same street that I once lived on, South Harrison Avenue, haunting my imagination. And that was In the American Grain by Paul Hendrickson. The author of numerous books teaches writing at the University of Pennsylvania. Up next, Royal Family Feud by Paul Thoreau. A feathered cape worn by a Hawaiian chief two centuries ago tells a story of human conflict and ecological tragedy. This magic feather cloak is a trophy from a bloody battle fought two centuries ago by two cousins with opposing views, a conflict that decided forever the cultural fate of Hawaii. One cousin, Lihaiolio Kamahamala II, was determined to end the ancient kapu system that regulated traditional customs, the veneration of gods, the conduct of eating, and much else. The other cousin, and excuse me for the pronunciation, Kikua Kanalani, was a traditionalist. To him, it is said, even a chief's shadow was sacred, and anyone who stepped into it must be killed. The ai kapu, the eating taboo, was also severe. Women were forbidden to eat bananas, for example, among other things. But the kapu had endured for centuries. It ordered Hawaii society. It conferred respect. It is related to our word, taboo. The dispute over this belief system became a battle that was fought at Kuamo near Kona on the Big Island of Hawaii toward the end of December 1819. Kekua Kalani was wearing the feather cloak, a sanctified symbol of his prestige. He was mortally wounded, and at his death on the battlefield, the cloak was stripped from him by the victim. His wife, Manono, fought furiously and died beside him. But even decisive battles are never so simple. This one would probably never have been fought in the way it was if foreigners from America, England, France, and Russia had not gone to Hawaii as plunderers, advisors, and traders, influential, not to say subversive, in their habits, swaggering through the islands, questioning the kapu, indifferent toward the gods, boasting of their firepower and their iron mongery. Most of these foreigners were in search of sandalwood, the fragrant timber that they sold for high prices to Chinese traders in Canton. Money did not figure in these sandalwood transactions. Firepower and iron took its place. Captain James Cook had established the tradition. In February 1779, when Cook took a fancy to an extravagant red feather cloak that the Holyhoe's father, Kamahamaha the Great, was wearing, the king handed it over to the English voyager in exchange for 7 iron daggers. The sandalwood traders offered Brown Bess muskets, pistols, ammunition, swords, powder, and flints. According to the British Royal Navy explorer George Vancouver, who would visit the islands in the 1790s, and others, the rifles were of inferior quality, antiquated and unreliable. But clashes in the islands among rival clans and chieftains boosted the trade in armaments, turning Hawaiian society into a gun culture. In view of the strife of contending chieftains, Ralph Kuykendall writes in his definitive work, The Hawaiian Kingdom, it is not strange to find in the contemporary literature of the period repeated references to the efforts of the chiefs to obtain cannons, muskets, and ammunition. Captain Douglas, in the spring of 1789, supplied Kamehameha with a quality of arms and ammunition, including a swivel gun mounted on the platform of a large double canoe. Kamehameha's son, Liholiho, inherited a substantial arsenal, as did Kekuakaliani. So it's not surprising that the Battle of Kuamos was a bloody one, blazing with cannon fire and the crack of pistols and muskets, as well as the thump of sling stones and spears, the clash of iron daggers, and undoubtedly the traditionalist Kekuakaliani side, the consecrated Liomano, the shark-toothed club favored by the god of war. The battle itself was waged over a number of days in a series of skirmishes, both in Kuamos and on the nearby sea, warriors fighting from their canoes with firearms, spears, and stones, including a swivel gun on a double-hulled canoe, possibly the one acquired in trade 30 years earlier. Historians estimate the dead in the hundreds. Today, the Hawaiian Cultural Preservation Group, Aloha Kuamo Aina, steward of the historic battlefield, promotes the view that, with her dying breath, Chiefess Manono is said to have uttered Malakmako Aloha, keep your love. A plea to both sides that no matter what obstacles come to Hawaii, keep your love for one another. The cloak was taken, and the bodies of Kekuakaliani and Manono and their fallen piled with stones. The old gods were overthrown. There was no veneration. But behold, 3 months after this battle, in March 1820, the first missionaries arrived from New England with holy Bibles and a new god to worship. The cloak, donated to the Smithsonian in 1947 by Princess Kauana Nanakoa, bears exquisite feathers plucked from fabulous birds that were prolific all over Hawaii. The black feathers are possibly from the black owls, the red perhaps from the scarlet Hawaiian honey creeper. But in any case, the owls and scores of other Hawaiian birds are extinct, the most melancholy feature of this beautiful thing. To listen authentic Hawaiian music from Smithsonian Folkways, go to smithsonianmag.com/feathercloak, one word. Repeating. To listen to authentic Hawaiian music from Smithsonian Folkways, go to smithsonianmag.com/feathercloak. Next up, On Hold, how a telephone monopoly and a fear of wiretapping hung up the answering machine for decades, by April White. In the spring of 1900, 24 years after Alexander Graham Bell introduced the telephone, a Danish inventor named Vladimir Poulsen unveiled the telegraphone at the Exposition Universelle in Paris. It was an engineering marvel. Poulsen recorded sound on a wire using nothing but a magnet, similar to the principle that underlies computer hard drives. And it was a minor social miracle, an antidote to Bell's constantly ringing telephone. The telegraphone was the world's first answering machine. It's easy to see that such an apparatus would be a great convenience, especially for a man of business, opined the London Daily News. The experts present professed astonishment at what it can do, the New York World announced, following tests in the United States. Not everyone was overjoyed. AT&T, which held a monopoly on the U.S. phone system and forbid the use of third-party technology, suppressed the innovation for more than half a century, according to research by Mark Clark, a historian of technology. If at any time there was a reasonable probability that such a device was connected at one end or the other, it would greatly restrict the use of the telephone, an AT&T executive wrote in 1930. A big concern was that the device would be used not just to answer calls, but to record conversations. The American Telegraphone Company, which had attempted unsuccessfully to market the machine, claimed that AT&T feared the device's ability to record calls. It would deter illegitimate uses of the telephone in corrupt business schemes and in social duplicity, thus depriving the phone company of up to a third of its business. Meanwhile, AT&T scientists were building their own version of the answering machine. For 6 months in 1934, callers to Bell Laboratories were greeted by a recorded message and prompted to leave their own. But it would be another 17 years before AT&T offered the technology to its customers. Next up, 2019 Smithsonian American Ingenuity Awards. There's a picture of a trophy, stylized skyscraper buildings on a base. Our 8th annual celebration of the creative breakthroughs shaping the world. Imaging a black hole required telescopes on 4 continents. A gene therapy discovery in Tennessee involved physicians from Poland and Germany. That sensational song by Lil Nas X included a beat produced in the Netherlands. Several achievements we salute here, it turns out, have an international dimension. Isn't it curious that our typical American openness to collaboration is often essential to ingenuity? The funny thing about the law. Her surprising drama about the Constitution encourages a wider view of American justice, by Neil Genslinger. Spend some money on your way out of a Broadway theater, and you can leave with an overpriced mug or t-shirt. Heidi Schreck sent people home from her show with a souvenir that is arguably much more valuable, and at no charge. A pocket-sized copy of the United States Constitution. Anyone who saw Schreck's play, What the Constitution Means to Me, during its 5-month Broadway run or on one of its tour stops, will surely never think of the country's founding document the same way again. If the play's title sounds like something from a high school speech contest, there's a reason for that. It was born of Schreck's experience as a teenager at Wench Chi High School in Washington in the 1980s, when she competed in American Legion oratorical contests. She won enough money doing so to pay for college at the University of Oregon. In the play, Schreck, who both wrote and starred in it, wryly recreates what she described as her teenage girl's bad romance with the Constitution. From that rather adorable premise, she embarks on a far-reaching examination of how the Constitution has applied, or not applied, to several generations of women in her family. She talks about the marginalization of women and other demographic groups, about domestic violence and sexual abuse. She calls out the founders and later interpreters of the Constitution for their male-centric view of the world. In her groundbreaking analysis of what she sees as a living document that can evolve with our times, Schreck began working on the play in 2007 when she was living in Brooklyn and performed a brief monologue at Public School 122, an alternative theater space in Manhattan's East Village, about her teenage debating experiences. I really started from the tiny spark that so many plays start from, she told me in an interview this past September, shortly after the play closed on Broadway and was beginning a run at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. I certainly didn't have a grand idea. Encouraged by the response to her initial effort, she set about expanding the piece. It was when she posed herself the challenges that her 15-year-old self was given during those contests. Find a personal connection between her life and the Constitution. That the work grew into a kind of feminist deconstruction of the nation's founding document. Schreck's earlier work, Grand Concourse, featured a soup kitchen in the Bronx as its setting, garnered a Lily Award in 2015 for Best New Play. She is also a screenwriter whose credits include the television series Nurse Jackie. What the Constitution means sort of took its own shape, she said. I felt as if the play led me. Schreck, who was briefly on a pre-law track in college before English and theater swept her away, turned herself into something of a constitutional expert, taking a deep dive into the mindset of the men who wrote the Constitution, who was left out of it, and how it has been shaped over time. In the play, she talks quite a bit about the Ninth Amendment, which says simply, "The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people." Or, as she puts it on stage, "The Constitution doesn't guarantee you the right to brush your teeth, but that doesn't mean you don't have that right." The Ninth Amendment has helped secure, for example, the right to use birth control. She enlarges, too, on the concept of negative rights versus positive rights, things that the government is expressly forbidden to infringe upon versus things that are proactively guaranteed. She studied up on the Constitution of other nations that have a greater emphasis on positive rights than does the U.S. Constitution. South Africa, for instance, guarantees the right to human dignity and to a healthy environment. "These constitutions," she said in an interview, "I find the language around human rights in them inspiring." Schreck performed the longer version of the play in 2017 at the Club Thumb Theater Company, also in East Village. From there it gathered momentum, which runs at Berkeley Repertory Theater in California and New York Theater Workshop. Performing in a small venue is one thing, telling a very personal story to almost 600 ticket holders per show, which she did for 169 performances at the Helen Hayes Theater on Broadway, was an adjustment. "I didn't imagine the level of exposure," she said. Talking about her sex life was nerve-wracking. So was performing the play with one particular person. Her mother, Sherry Chastain Schreck, was in the audience for the first time. "It was opening night on Broadway. The first performance was hard. My mother was very emotional. I was very emotional," Schreck recalled. But, she added, "Mom went back several times." The response from the audience also helped get her through the discomfort, as she realized her tale was resonating. "The biggest thing," she said, "is that people like to stay and tell me about their own stories." And that's going to wrap it up for today. We hope you've enjoyed today's reading of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.